and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, Motivating the Masses. This is with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brennan and Joe Kirk. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
So, yeah, this session around motivation, around training, there was a lot to uncover, really. I think we did a good job at it. I think people in the chat did a good job at it. There was conversation was flowing.
I thought there was some great interaction and people got some fantastic ideas. Well, you know, that's what comes across. Yeah. We're very fortunate to have such a great community of people with, you know, with bad ideas that they're prepared to share. And, you know, there's some great stuff came out of that discussion, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to bribing people with food as well when it comes to data protection, which I will happily be bribed by food. So I'm not too against that idea.
Yeah, a lot. We decided that, you know, a lot come down to culture. We talked through, you know, some of the challenges of you know, getting people to do things that they don't necessarily want to do, and, you know, monitoring them and fine tuning them. And I thought it was, you know, useful session.
Yeah, I agree. What were your thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, I thought it was a great session. Lots of interaction from the chat.
What was your highlight?
My highlight was probably the antidote that Vaughan shared on, you know, the things that he's got in place, kind of stripping it back and, you know, talking as if it's just a conversation. And I think he mentioned about dropping in on meetings. But if you want to hear, you know, the full force of it, you'll have to listen to the whole session, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I did think you were going to explain it all just then. We are learning.
I think my takeaway out of it is the kind of the holistic nature of what we need to do, you know, as privileged practitioners. We talked through some of the formal training, we've talked through some of the informal kind of, so we talked through some of the awareness raising techniques, we talked about gamifying it. I mean, there's some fab stuff. If you kind of take all of that and put it all together, you know, how could you possibly go wrong?
Well, no, I liked one suggestion, and it was someone had set up potential breaches in an office setting and hidden Haribos where each of the breaches were, and if people picked up on them, then they win a Haribo. I thought that was quite a clever idea, really.
Escape room. Somebody mentioned escape rooms as well, didn't they? There was lots really good stuff. Yeah,
creative.
Very good. Yeah.
But yeah, we will let you get into the main part of the session. If you do want to hear, you know, more about what training we actually provide, then let us know. But we hope you enjoy the session for now. Thank you. I'm not sure about the both of you.
Yeah, it's been a few things. Not that much in the news this week, I don't think, but there's been some interesting stuff. What was something that caught your... Aye.
Well, the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill is
the extension. Strange. So, I thought that was a bit strange, actually. Dave rang me and said, "Oh, the DPEI bill's been scrapped." I said, "What?" So anyway, I looked into it, and it hasn't been scrapped. What they've done is they've applied for an extension. So I think it was due to expire. It expires after 12 months, doesn't it? If it's been on the parliamentary calendar, it's due to expire in November. But there was an application to extend the deadline to the middle of December.
Yeah, the 12th.
12th of December, yeah. So, they just got that extra couple of weeks.
Mm. Still, the next election's due to run, is it on the 17th of December? So
latest, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so...
So there is speculation as to whether they will manage to get it through before the general election.
I'm pretty sure I read online or... saw online that it said that Rishi Sunak's aiming for October election, I think.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, someone wants to, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what I read.
Well, I'm sure that the DPDI bill won't feature in his plans about when to call the election. But,
I'm just thinking if there is a change of power, then it could get completely abolished. So it's something to keep your eye on, isn't it?
Yeah. It is interesting how, you know, how it's kind of going, and it's been on the cards for 2 years. Again, I've read that it's been rumbling around Parliament for 2 years, you know, and it's fallen off, I think, once or twice, hasn't it? And it's got brought back on the agenda. But, you know, whether it Yes, it will depend on, you know, the political will at the time, and you know what the priorities are, and the timing of the election, and you know what support it's got. We'll see how it goes. Sian says she's slightly relieved it's delayed. I think we're majorly relieved it's been delayed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it'll either, you know, hopefully it'll either mean that it is abolished altogether or that it is actually subject to sufficient review, which I don't think it'll be so much that case, but let's just hope for the abolishment, really.
we'll see. Yeah. I mean yes, if they run out of time they run out of time, and then we'll just see what the next government does.
It reiterates the importance, though, of, you know, there's a lot of people I talk to who are trying to prepare for it.
I know, and because the other day, yeah.
Yeah, there's just no point, because you can't really, you don't know what's going to change. You know, the last time they put it through and there was all the slight amendments, you know, some minor changes which were obviously not the case. You just can't really preempt it, and there's no point. It's a waste of resource until you know for sure what's going to happen.
Well, that's my view as well. Yeah, we had a customer asking us to help them kind of plan for it, and our response was, well, we can, but I mean, there's no real point. The only thing that's worth probably thinking about is the senior responsible individual. You know, where's he going to sit? How's it going to work? Sian's treading carefully in case we're all fans of the Data Protection and the Digital Information Bill, but I have to say we're not massive fans of it. We don't think it. We think it's weakens the position. We've talked about this a number of times, haven't we? About why we think it weakens the position. Data protection law in the country, and one of the things that I was a bit confused about with this session was what this motivating the masses was going to be all about. So we'll come on to that later. But one of the things, again, I'm going to throw out there later on, is that all the public, you know, discussion in the media about this DPDI bill and whether it's good, whether it's bad, it must surely undermine management's resolve to get data protection, you know, embedded in the business. You know, if they think it might be all changing and getting watered down, and you know, we don't need a DPO anymore, we don't need to keep ropes anymore, we don't need to do this, well, that doesn't really help us as privacy practitioners or professionals, does it, really?
Yeah, I mean, not
all that
at all.
Speculation.
I mean, it's hard enough, you know, to get senior management or board on board with, you know, approving costs, let's say, for training in this example, as it is. And then when there's the message of red tape around data protection that's already being displayed by the government, then it just, you know, it further pushes people's perceptions who aren't, you know, they don't live and breathe data protection maybe as much as they should down that road. So
I think more importantly, it also puts data subjects at jeopardy as well. I mean, you know, we are data subjects in our own right when we're out in the world, and obviously as an employee of data protection people. So I know that things might not be a legal requirement, but organisations might still do it. But I'm sure there'll be quite a few organisations out there that will probably, you know, follow the law and take a step back. And obviously that puts you at jeopardy, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this ULEZ fines scandal is rumbling on, isn't it? I don't know if you've seen anything in the press about that. The Transport for London, because I read something in The Guardian that the Italian police have been accused of providing the information to the private company behind the Transport for London fines scheme. They've denied it. And it's interesting because, you know, the truth will come out about this, won't it? It's interesting everyone's denying, you know, oh, no, it's not us, and oh, no, it's not us, and oh, no, we haven't done that, because it will come out. But that's rumbling on, isn't it? That's quite interesting, the way this is, how this is going to land. You know, Europark in this private company are issuing these fines left, right and centre. It's just a bit of a mess, isn't it, really? I have to say, I can't help but smile about it, thinking, all the Brexit really has caused this lack of communication between the authorities, and if you want sovereignty, you got it.
While we're on the topic of supposedly weak laws, did you see that there's a surveillance law update that's also coming in the UK? It's a new bill that's set to enable the security and intelligence agencies to keep pace with a range of evolving threats against a backdrop of accelerating technological advancements, apparently. However, upon closer inspection, the proposed bill does not do exactly as it says. I think it's an update to the Investigatory Powers Act from 2016.
I saw that, yeah.
So the three proposed things that are, you know, it doesn't exactly inspire confidence is that the bill proposes that the security services should have much more latitude in building and exploiting so-called bulk data sets of personal information. For example, data about individuals who have low or no expectation of privacy. And the concern is that this could allow the collection and use of CCTV footage or the 20 billion facial images scraped from the internet by Clearview on the grounds that those of us who appear in such data sets have no expectation of privacy, apparently. And the Open Rights Group points out that the bill permits the harvesting and processing of internet connection records, for example, metadata, the numbers you called, your location, the app you used, etc. And then the final one was a measure that would force technology companies, including those based overseas, to inform the UK government of any plans they might have to improve security or privacy measures on their platforms before those changes are implemented. And I think this has caused a bit of backlash from Apple, who have said they will remove services such as FaceTime and iMessage from the UK rather than weaken security if new proposals are made from, you know, by the law. So it's not just data protection bills that are being watered down by UK Parliament.
It's interesting. I saw read something about the Federal Trade Commission in the US are blocking a data broker from selling and licensing the use of really precise geolocation data, which was why it's interesting. Is it's obviously in the States where there's no kind of federal privacy law. So I haven't got to the bottom of, you know, why they've intervened, but yeah, the type of information that's being collected. interestingly, this company called InMarket has been collecting very precise location data and segmenting the consumers into about 2,000 different audience categories. Things like, you know, well-off suburban mums, parents of preschoolers, wealthy but not healthy, you know, that type of thing. And because they're like precisely tracking location, they can see, you know, for instance, what vehicle manufacturer's showroom you've been in to have a look at the vehicles. And then they use that to target advertising at you. Now, they said in the app that people use for kind of electronic shopping and shopping rewards, that that's what they were going to do. But the Federal Trade Commission is saying it wasn't clear and the consent statement wasn't linked to the privacy policy. So there's some quite interesting technical things in there, you know, but the direction of travel is, you know, we're not comfortable with you doing this. And, you know, it seems like they're picking at things like, you know, because you haven't said it in your privacy policy, but it just seems like, quite that they're uncomfortable with it, which I was interested in kind of looking at, particularly as it's in the US.
Yeah, US law is always fascinating, isn't it? I've actually had to do a little bit of research recently into direct marketing into the US. And there's not really much resource out there. I mean, I didn't spend too long on it. You know, obviously we're not experts, are we, of US law, but I was trying to find a little bit of guidance relating specifically to postal services out there. But it's always interesting, isn't it, looking out and doing a bit of research on other laws around the world and seeing how they kind of stand up to that of the GDPR.
Yeah, it's good. And there's some really good stuff. As I said before on this session that I've been doing some work on the Jamaican Data Protection Act, and I've read about the Nigerian one yesterday. There's custodial sentences, you know, written into the law, which, you know, we don't have in the data protection law in this country. You know, we've had people jailed for Computer Misuse Act where there are custodial sentences, but it's a missed opportunity personally. But, you know, it's interesting that other jurisdictions have got it in there and we're hit sitting on our high horse saying, no, we don't think they're adequate.
Well, I think even if it was in place here, I don't think the commissioner would go out his way to try and put people in jail because he doesn't hold organisations responsible, does he, for those that infringe the law. So I'm not sure why he'd specifically target individuals.
No, but just having that there as one of the potential penalties is probably a deterrent, you know, should be a deterrent.
It might motivate you, Phil, into having decent practices within your organisation.
But you suggested I don't.
I was trying to leeway into the main topic of the session.
I wasn't talking about the news.
I'm not, but it was just a nice segue.
It was, yeah.
But instead, he took it as a personal attack.
No, it's the way you phrase it. Your emphasis on you. I was only joking. Right, the week started off with a couple of school hacks as well. There was one round near me, and who'd been, well, not near me, but neck of the woods in Billingham, where a school app called Class Charts, which is a popular, apparently popular pupil monitoring platform, somebody had hacked into that and sent extremely rude messages to the parents and to the pupils on it. And they were issuing rewards for aggressive behaviour and things like that. So the news story said it was looks like it was a childish prank that somebody had carried out, but that wasn't good. And then I read about another educational app called Lecture Notes getting hacked. And actually, a lot of information was taken off that, including session tokens. And the worry there is that people can use those session tokens potentially to log into a session without authenticating, you know, i.e. taking over the user's session. So that was, but this is all driving back to, you know, what due diligence do you think is appropriate on these kind of apps? Just because the school down the road's using them or the academy's using them, you know, doesn't mean to say that they've done thorough due diligence either.
Yeah, I mean, it's a worry if it's, you know, a couple of children that have hacked into the first one that you spoke about. What was the app called?
It was called Class Charts.
Yeah, Class Charts. You know, if it's that vulnerable that a couple of children, I mean, don't get me wrong, they're growing up in a technical age, but if they can hack into that, then there can't be much controls around it.
Well, you say that, but do you remember the story about was it a 15-year-old boy, was it, Phil?
Was it
Uber or was it the something? He is in a Travelodge, wasn't he? And he used the TV to hack into.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was, but it was
he bought a Fire Stick, and he used the Fire Stick to hack into a corporate network of some big American tech company. Might be Uber. I can't remember.
Yeah, I do remember something like that with Uber, and he was he logged onto the Slack messaging platform and was just, I don't know, I think just showing them up, really.
Right,
Kaylee said in the chat, apparently kids have hacked TalkTalk's AI system as well. Speaking of AI, have you heard about the new AI ISO accreditation or certification even? ISO 42001, I believe it is.
I've bought a copy of it so I can read through it. I've not read it yet.
Yeah, it's, I think from what I've heard or read, it's supposed to, replicate ISO 27001, but from an AI perspective. So, yeah, it's positive anyway.
Yeah. Right, you're itching, are you not, Joe, to get into this main session?
Yeah, I guess so. It's, you know, it's what the people are here to listen about. So Ben, sorry, just before we move on, Ben's just asked what the ISO number is. Jazz, if you could just pop it in the chat. Main topic of the session, motivating the masses. So I guess it's a little bit of an open-ended question, isn't it, of how you motivate your employees. Is it just your employees that you're motivating? In terms of data protection compliance, where do you even begin with something, you know, as broad as this?
Well, it made me stop and think when I read the brief motivating the masses. I thought, what on earth is this going to be about? You know, it's a good title. It sounds more like an essay title than a podcast title. But, you know, it made me think about, you know, what is motivation? How can we motivate people? And what are we actually trying to motivate them to do? You know, can we pinpoint it specifically? You know, what's the role of motivation in training and awareness, or the other way around? What's the role of training awareness in, you know, driving motivation? You know, so it definitely got my cogs whirring when I was thinking about it and preparing.
And what is your answer to that, Phil?
42.
No, I think, to be honest, I was coming into this session thinking, you know, we'd be focusing on training, but the idea of motivation and motivating the masses is so much broader than that. And it really gave some food for thought. You know, there's let's say, for example, training of staff.
Interesting. I'm going to dive just onto this chat. Helen's been asked to develop a DP game, which is fabulous. Now, I know, because I read in the news years ago, that a housing association had developed a DP game for their training. I could never remember who it was. So I actually asked ChatGPT about it this morning, and it came up and told me it was Orbit. And I don't think it was Orbit. But I found an article in The Guardian, which I'll put in here, about this from 2013. But there are some quite good games out there, and I think there's some really good stuff you could develop into some data protection games. We've got some games we play ourselves, but I was thinking like a board game. I don't know what you've got in mind, Helen. I just find this link.
Really?
Here it is.
Is this a game, is it? I'm sure, have you not gone through a game of us before on this podcast, Phil? Or
you're not dreaming things. I developed a Stakes and Ladder board game a long time ago. Yeah, we play Breach or No Breach in training. We do Spin the Bottle as well. Yeah, I got into trouble for this. I went to somewhere and it used to be like roulette, and it was spinning the barrel of a revolver, and everyone really got upset about it. And that, so I changed to Spin the Bottle, and still people were upset about it. We should have a team effort on this, Helen, a brainstorm or whatever you now call them on here to try and get some ideas.
I mean, we all love a quiz.
I love a quiz.
We've got a deck of cards as well that a company called Security Metrics have produced, which is Cards Against Security. They're on my desk in the office. And it's like 52 cards, and there's various scenarios. And I've got a game at home called Worst Case Scenario, which again is a card game. And it's got, you know, for instance, you know, you've lost a bag containing a laptop. You know, should you do A, B, C, or D? That type of thing. So there's loads of things you could do to develop out.
I must say though, Cards Against Security is probably not work appropriate in terms of delivering training from a game side of things. I think that's more insulting people in the security sector. So probably the less we talk about that, the better. But I think gaming is a game of such is a great idea to keep people motivated, and it's a good way of also checking in to see if anyone's actually been listening. And if you've been delivering training over Teams, for example, it's very easy for people just to switch off. I mean, one, they can have the cameras off. And even if you ask them to have the cameras on, it's very easy, isn't it, just to pull something up above you where your webcam is, and it looks like you're paying attention. But in actual fact, you don't know that they're sat there reading something up on LinkedIn, for example. So, chess.
I've just been playing chess.
Is that what you've been doing, is it, Phil? You're not paying attention, you sat playing chess.
Yeah.
But no, it's a good way, isn't it, of kind of just checking in with people and making sure that they're fully paying attention to the training that you're delivering.
Yeah. Now, Rebecca said about Lego. Now, I was in London at a risk show, I think it was a couple of years ago, and there's this initiative called Cyber Griffin that I know quite a few of the listeners in the past or the podcast participants in the past have said, yeah, I've heard about that. And Cyber Griffin is the police will come and do a cyber training session with you free of charge. And they use Lego to kind of build up this environment. And then they show you where the weaknesses are in your cyber. It's really clever, actually. So I've put a link to that in the chat here. They do it for free. So I've seen that with using Lego to do training. I don't know if you're talking about something different, Rebecca, but there's lots of different things out there. We just need to... An escape room sounds a great idea as well. There's some great ideas, aren't there?
I know. I'd like to see how the escape room works. To be fair, I don't know if it would be like a business continuity type thing. You know, if there's a fire in the storage in the data center or something.
Yeah, maybe. So, I was thinking, well, what is, you know, motivation? You know, because that was the title of the topic, and you know, I ended up looking for a definition of it to try and help frame my thinking about the session. And, you know, it according to Wikipedia, it's kind of an internal state that propels individuals to engage in goal-directed behavior. So, you know, thinking that, you know, this is about motivating the masses. You know, who are the masses, as you said earlier on, Jasmine? Who are we trying to influence here? Is it just our colleagues? Is it our suppliers? Is it our customers? Is it our peers in similar organizations? You know, where do we start, you know, with a topic like this?
I think you've got to start by looking at what the current situation is, you know, what your existing culture is and where probably the biggest red flags are. If there's, starting from the top down, really, if there's issues with the board getting on board, I suppose, you know, they've got some reflection to do. And then if, you know, if they're backing the importance of data protection, then you've got to look on an individual level at staff practices. You know, are they storing things locally, or is the, you know, are they following standard procedure and things like that? If, you know what I find as well, I think I've probably mentioned it before, but no matter, there's no stupid questions with data protection. If you're a DPO and you're getting asked all sorts of questions, is this an issue, or can I do this in this instance, and it might not even be something related to personal data at all, the important part is that they're asking those questions and that they're thinking of data protection. It's at the forefront of the mind, and you know, they are taking that naturally, that risk-based approach. And it's in motivating staff, you've got to consider how to do that, how to make people care, really.
Well, yeah, the other thing I was thinking about, what when you is, you know, we've got some good generalizations about what we're trying to achieve, but you know, what is the desired behaviors that we're trying to get, you know, out of people? Are we trying to get them to understand data protection? Are we trying to get them to embrace data protection, or be an evangelize about it, or just follow the rules that we've created? Or, you know, are we asking them to call out people who aren't following the rules? Are we looking and asking them to look out better ways of doing jobs? Are we looking them to kind of adopt zero tolerance to situations? I think maybe all of that, I don't know. I mean, Joe and I were looking at a case this week which was really interesting, because we have a customer that is recording calls. It's mandatory. All calls in and out get recorded on their VoIP platform. And you can't pause a call recording. And so if people pass over special category data, which they do apparently, about their medical conditions, about disabilities, when they're talking about, you know, related things about their where they're living, that's special category data. It's being recorded. It's being stored. It's being processed. What's the lawful basis for it? Customer says it's explicit consent. Joe and I say, well, how does that work? You know, how do you obtain explicit consent, you know, at that moment in time? And what if people don't want to consent? You know, how do you, you know, stop that? Oh, we can't stop the call recording. Well, is that good enough? I was thinking, you know, why can't you stop the call recording? Oh, because we, you know, the supplier that we're in contract with doesn't provide that on their platform. Well, you know, frankly, is that good enough? I don't think it is. You know, I would have thought the whole organization would be up in arms saying this isn't good enough. But no, what they're trying to do is they're looking to kind of, in my opinion, fudge it and go with, oh, we'll use explicit consent. You know, we'll have a statement at the start of the call, you know, that we're going to record calls. But that's not explicit consent, is it? That's just general consent. And, you know, if you want to withdraw your consent, you can't, you know, you'd have to say, no, we're going to have to ring us on a different line where we don't do call recording. So it just wasn't, it was just interesting, wasn't it, Joe, looking at that?
It was, yeah. And it's frustrating as well, isn't it? Because it's, you know, it's clear that they've not done proper due diligence on the organisations. If you're aware that you're collecting special category data, then, you know, you should be aware that you're going to need an Article 9 lawful basis. And therefore, depending on obviously what you're collecting it for, it's substantial public interest, but we couldn't find one of their conditions to meet, could we, this purpose? No, so it was the option was explicit consent is the most appropriate, but you have to be able to have ways around it in terms of the call recordings and have been able to stop the call recordings. It wasn't freely given either, was it? Because I think if you're ringing up to get assistance with something, and you, oh no, hang on, I don't want to give my consent, but I need assistance, then you're being forced into giving that consent, aren't you? And it's not a free choice.
It's good comments in the chat about this. And you know, bringing it back to this topic here, you know, it's like, well, why are these, you know, people in the organization accepting that as acceptable practice? Why aren't they pushing back, saying, no, we need a budget to get this fixed because it's not acceptable? That's really where I'm coming from on this. You know, what is it, what we're trying to motivate our colleagues to do, you know, just to follow the rules, or to open their eyes and have a look at what's going on around them and say, no, that ain't good enough. It needs improving.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point as well when you think of what motivating the masses is. Could that include customers? You know, do you spread awareness of, you know, data protection to them as well by advising, you know, that obviously through privacy information, how their information will be handled, but in thinking about data minimization and what you collect and advising them, you know, we will be collecting this information. Have, you know, think about that before you tell us your life story, essentially, whether you're a therapist or not. But I think there's some roles, isn't there, say, in a social care setting or housing or whatever it is, where you've got to record anything that they tell you for their protection, maybe if they've got a disability or this, you know, particularly vulnerable. But then you get backlash from that sometimes, where the individual will say, well, I don't want you to collect this information, I want you to delete it all, but it goes against their interests by deleting that information because you need it to protect them. So this whole understanding of how data protection and, you know, legislation and the GDPR etc. is applied is just as important to customers. It doesn't all come down to consent, really.
No, exactly. We were talking this morning, Joe and I, about another case. It's quite nice talking about these cases because they're real life examples of the challenges that people are having. And in this case, it was, you know, we've got a personal evacuation plan, presumably kind of like, you know, people living potentially in a high rise building, and you know, they may have certain, you know, reasons for needing help during an evacuation, event of a fire or even a fire drill or you know, a bomb scare or something. So, you know, this information about, you know, potentially disabilities, about maybe hearing difficulties, maybe about certain medical conditions, is on these personal evacuation plans for the people it needs to be on. So the question was, what's the lawful basis for processing this? And again, the client was saying consent. We're saying no, consent doesn't work in these circumstances. Because if you've got to think about the reality is, you know, if the building goes on fire, you're gonna get this information and you're gonna use it. You're not gonna think
regardless
about consent
of whether they consented or not.
So consent doesn't work from a practical point of view. So it doesn't feel right. And if it doesn't feel right, it's probably not right. So we had a look through, again, substantial public interest conditions, and we thought that, you know, these individuals are probably arguably at risk, you know, and arguably you'd say, well, we don't think, you know, that condition about why you haven't got consent, you know, it's not reasonably practicable in the circumstances. I would say it's probably not practical in the circumstances, because if people do object, it will undermine your duty to evacuate people safely from the building. So we kind of talked around that, went with that. But it's interesting how sometimes difficult it is to pin a lawful basis is on this. We talked about the Article 6 basis, and Joe was saying, well, could it be, you know, a legal obligation? It could be under health and safety law, but if it isn't explicitly an obligation under health and safety law, then it would be a legitimate interest to comply with health and safety law. So, you know, either way, there's probably two Article 6 and one Article 9 basis. But again, these are great things we get to work with and to talk about as a team.
I know. I think in that scenario, whose responsibility is it to, you know, set a lawful basis? Surely that should be with the data protection lead, because, you know, it's not really for anybody in the organisation to decide what the most appropriate lawful basis is, because they're not really expected to have that depth of knowledge. But it, you know, if that's with the data protection lead or the DPO, then they should be having sufficient training to make sure that they've, you know, that they know how to apply lawful basis, what the most appropriate one is, etc. It's so complicated, though.
If they're not 100% sure, that they might have a support contract with DPP, and they can reach out to myself and ask for my opinion.
And then you'll kick it around a team of about 15 privacy practitioners and
speak
therefore
about it on the podcast.
Probably get a reasonable.
At least we'd get an answer eventually, though.
These personal evacuation plans. Carl's saying he's relied on legitimate interest to make clear that each resident, each put an application, we can undertake your ongoing care by planning to do this. Yeah, because Joe and I were talking about what if somebody objected, and we would probably be saying, well, we're going to override the objection, you know, it could be that it's different in a low rise type of residential arrangement than a high rise. You might say, well, it's not actually necessary, but, you know, it's like devil's in the detail, isn't it?
So just going back to my previous point, how do you decide what training is appropriate? You know, obviously it's going to differ from a DPO to the rest of the organization. What level of depth do you go into? It's these kinds of things that we need to consider. It's not just, you know, annual refresher training. Here's the basics of data protection. It needs to be specific to the individual and their role across the organization.
And the organization. So the, your generic deep GDPR type training, this is the GDPR, these are the principles, blah, 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 blah. You know, that's fine. But the real training, I think, that that needs to be done is, and this is what to do in the event of an incident. And this is what to do in the event of a rights request. And this is how to respond, you know, if you're, if you, you know, see something that you don't think is right. You know, that's the surely the most important aspect of the training. You know, what that means here in this establishment. And a lot of it might be similar, you know, incident, you know, log it here, notify that person, high risk processing, you know, pull out the DPIA procedure, etc. But I think, you know, again, I see a lot of that training not happening. And I think that people over rely on this e-learning, you know, generic GDPR stuff.
100%, you know, working in a sales role, a lot of people that I talk to about training, some of them, well, I mean, it's very divided. Some of them want that tick box exercise. I had a conversation with someone last week who'd had a, you know, they'd had a breach in the organization, so they wanted senior management training, and then ended up going for the half an hour video, you know, that we provide, and that's for induction training and maybe refresher across the organization. It's not sufficient for senior managers to recognize and appropriately handle breaches. It's irritating, but obviously, you know, it's just an uphill battle, I feel. You know, there are improvements across across businesses. I was looking actually at the cyber statistics, you know, the national statistics from last year, and there has been an increase over the last couple of years in data protection, or well, cybersecurity training across organizations, quite drastically, to be fair. So in large businesses in 2021, it was 47%. That's now risen to 77% in 2023. But
back to your point, this is about quality, not quantity, isn't it? So you know, you might have trained everybody in something that's not actually that effective.
Yeah. I mean,
sorry, go on.
No, it's all right.
What I was going to say, and do organisations see training as just a tick box exercise? Yeah, we'll just put this slideshow together. This is what you need to know. Send it out. Done it. Yeah, tick a box. Moving on. As opposed to actually sitting down and understanding where your employees' knowledge is at in terms of recognising a breach, for example, Jasmine. Yeah. I think scenarios are a great point, aren't they, of trying to bring these things alive and having like in-person workshops. I mean, I think I've mentioned it before. I did some international data transfer training to some of the support desk team about 6 months ago, and I did a quiz, but also at the end I had three specific scenarios relating to international transfers. Okay, so this data is going here. What needs to be in place? And, you know, I had different scenarios of different, you know, different territories, and that obviously require different safeguards. And it just makes people think, doesn't it, about, you know, the things that you just kind of explained to them, now put it into practical, and can you actually identify and notice, okay, so that data is going to Canada, and then we know that they have partial adequacy, so if it's caught by the partial adequacy requirement, then they only need a data process agreement in place, otherwise you need additional safeguards under Article 46, and then so on.
Yeah, we've got levels to our training, and it's like, you know, for staff, let's say in the setting of a housing association that has a contractor that goes out and needs names and addresses to visit houses to fix their electrics, whatever it is, they will only handle minimal data. So that video that I explained would be, you know, possibly sufficient for them. Then you get staff who deal with more personal data that need more explaining, like you say, Joe, they need to digest it. I think consultant delivered, or you know, in-person delivered training is much more effective. It's really important to actually make sure that people do understand it, they can ask questions and so on. But then you get another level of, you know, people on this call who live and breathe data protection, and a couple of hours, you know, on a session isn't going to teach, as most people will understand in this, it's not going to teach you everything you need to know about data protection. It's difficult as it is, you know, with it always changing and whatnot. So I suppose for that, we would apply our data protection officer training course, wouldn't we, which is 8 weeks. But it does equip you to be able to identify what is required within your organization and how to do that in practice, really.
Yeah. There's some really good things in the chat here. I absolutely agree with Rebecca saying, you know, that kind of anchoring the training in. There's a few people who've said anchoring the training in how it affects you as a data subject, you know, is good, kind of, because if you start off like that, you know, this is your personal life, this is what you're doing, what about the data, let's have a look at it, you know, let's see where it's going, oh, it's going to this country, you know, how does that make you feel? That, you know, that's quite a good way of getting it across to people that it's affecting them, then applying it into the work. I wasn't doing training, I was talking to somebody about how to create records for processing activities last week, and you know, I'm certainly saying this because Rebecca's talking about, you know, helping people understand the history and the context and the, you know, why we're where we are. So I was running through, you know, the history of ropers really, and the fact I showed the old forms that we used to have to fill in the information commissioner's notification handbook, you know, pages and pages and pages of forms you had to fill in for each of the data processing purposes. So that's how it used to be, and that's where this has all come from. Then it all got watered down, and eventually they said it didn't work, chuck it over to each organization to keep these records themselves. And I think that what she said afterwards, it helped to get it into context, understand why we were doing it and the level of detail to go into as well, because that notification handbook is pretty good at helping to identify the kind of level of detail that a roper probably should be going to. So some good things in the chat here.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I like this one from Nikki. She said, last time I did training on data protection, I found the team were very much motivated by Haribos. I hid some breaches around the room, passwords, confidential documents, etc., and rewarded them with the sweets. It was really interesting to see which were more obvious to them. I really like that.
Well, this is back to kind of motivation as well, because I mean, there seems to be two angles to motivation, you know, the carrot and the stick. You know, the stick is your disciplinary action, you know, your carrot is potentially, you know, rewards or, you know, time off or recognition, those kind of things. But, you know, back to the session of building that framework out, you know, these are the things we're going to use as sticks, peer group pressure, you know, set of rules, disciplinary or whatever, and these are the things we're going to use to recognize good practice. But, you know, I suppose you've got to identify what the practice you want in the first place is in order to be able to recognize whether people are doing or not. I'm also going to come back to Carl as well. He's saying, you know, don't let data protection law stop us doing what is right. And I absolutely agree with that. You know, if it doesn't look right, don't feel right, it's probably not right, you know. And, you know, but data practitioners have got to have the confidence to say, you know, that's not right, you know, we've got to do it a different way. And sometimes you need a network and a forum, you know, of colleagues to bounce ideas off, but not everyone's got that confidence to say, I think I'm right, because often it is, I think I'm right, there's no evidence I am right, I just think I'm right, and therefore I'm going to go down this track. And you might find that the whole business is pushing against you, particularly when you're saying you can't be doing this in terms of direct marketing, not unless you change your tack to that. The whole business is saying, but they do it, and you know, so on and so forth. It's quite a lonely place sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. And that's why we put these sessions on, though, isn't it? So people can come and kind of, you know, put these questions to not just us, but other people in the chat. I mean, I often find myself coming to you, Phil, if I'm not quite too sure on a case. I say, I think I know the answer to this query that is coming from a customer. I just want to double check it just to make sure I'm on the right path. But touching on that thing that Nikki's put in regarding, you know, driving motivation through rewards such as Haribo, how do you actually motivate people at an organization that probably, I mean, maybe a little bit harsh to say because some might, but don't care about keeping hold of personal data and keeping it secure? I mean, take for example a massive organization like Google. You know, the people that are just there to work and do the groundwork at the organization, they're probably not paid as much as those that hire up. You know, they're just there to work their hours, do the job and get gone. How do you keep people like that motivated within your organization to do things that is probably, I mean, outside of their day-to-day responsibility in terms of doing just their normal job? I mean, I guess you're going to say that it is their responsibility and it should be part of their job description, perhaps.
I was going to say that culture, I think, plays a huge part in this, you know, and that blows down from senior management, senior leadership team. So,
Vaughan's got a bit of an answer here as well. He said, as well as our e-learning for all colleagues, I visit teams and engage in their meetings to talk data protection. I ask them to tell me what personal data they use, how they manage it, and what they think the risks are. The conversational style I find much more engaging and can correct them when they're wrong or don't understand. It also ensures they understand data protection within the context of their own day-to-day work and makes it relevant. It also means every meeting and discussion is different as every team works differently. So it is that, you know, keeping it relevant to people and really making the cogs turn in their own heads and being able to apply it in their own way rather than saying, look, this is data protection, go off and make sure that you comply with it. It's like, oh, okay, this is what this means in my day-to-day work.
But it's great that, you know, you got data protection practitioners out there, feet on the ground, getting in amongst them. That's brilliant. Everyone's got a hand raised.
And here I am. Here I am talking as well as time. Sorry for the big long one. Yeah, thanks, Jasmine. Yeah, we obviously have the kind of e-learning training, which everyone does, but I've just found that there's lots of different teams use the same personal data, but in lots of different ways, depending on what they do, whether it's because I'm in a housing association, we've got the rents team, the tenancy sustainment team, the repairs team. They're all dipping into the same database, but they're using the data in lots of different ways. Some transmit it, some collect it. Some use it for subject access requests, things like that. But if they're in a room where they feel safe, when they're with their own colleagues from that team, they can all join in and talk. Whereas if you get them in a room with lots of other people from different departments, sometimes they feel a bit embarrassed to talk about the stuff that they do.
Mm.
And I think going to team meetings and actually my meeting normally starts with, you tell me about data protection. I'm not going to tell you. You tell me what you think you know. Mm. You've been on the e-learning, you've probably dipped into the policy, which you have to do in our organisation when you start and annually. A bit of a dry topic, I wouldn't expect them to rattle that off to me. But it's good to gauge how much they think they know and where they might be wrong. And there's nothing wrong with not knowing everything, and they know that, but they'll also feel in a safe place to tell me what they think the risks are. And I can tell them, yeah, they are or they're not. Or sometimes I'll have to go away with stuff. And I'll have to say that it depends sentence again, and then I'll get back to you. But you learn a lot more as a data protection officer when you listen to how they're actually managing and processing the data. Because how I think they do it is probably not how they do it at all.
Mm.
They know what they do with the data, and I'm just trying to find out. So very often I sit with my hands under my legs and just say, you tell me, I'm not going to train you in data protection. You've had your training. You tell me what you've learned from it. What do you think personal data is? What do you think processing is? And it's a conversation, really. And they can then just tell me what they think it is.
That sounds really good and really approachable. That sounds. Yeah. How frequently would you do those kind of things, Vaughan?
I tend to try and do a team meeting. I will go to a team meeting and take over their team meeting, and they're happy for me to do so. I'll probably do maybe one a month or one every 6 weeks with different teams. Depends who the team is. I'll try and get back to them. So I might do a team twice a year if I can. It depends, really. Some of them are a lot more customer facing than others. And as I say, some are talking with people, some are dealing with digital data, some are dealing with more sensitive data. So the context within which they're using the data differs greatly.
Mm.
And it's important they see me and know me and they can engage with me. And rightly or wrongly, I get calls all the time about data protection. You know, I'll get people worried about stuff and call me, and sometimes there's nothing to worry about. But I'm glad that they call me and they ask me and they're concerned about it. So it's kind of worked for me because they know who I am and I engage with them and I'm not scary. And I don't tend to talk legislation too much. They're looking for me to enable them to do their work. That's what they know I try and do. They want me to help them do whatever it is, whatever goal they're trying to reach. They contact me and hopefully I can help them do what they want to do by putting the right things in place. And I'll say, well, you're going to need consent for that. We need to look at where you're storing that data and how long you're going to keep it for. Do you really need what you're asking for? How are you going to use that? Have we got that somewhere else? So, you know, those kind of conversations are really useful. And also they're the conversations where you find out the grenade that they've been hiding that they suddenly throw in at the end, which changes everything. And you go, well, you should have told me that at the start. What? Don't leave that to the end. That's fundamental. So, yeah, I found it's probably multifaceted. I think we've got the policy, which you can read. We've got the e-learning, which is probably, I think, overly comprehensive, but comprehensive nevertheless. And then the conversational style and engagement. And once you build up that relationship, I think they're more likely to come to you. They know who you are. They can put a face to you.
Mm.
Yeah, because you host workshops as well, you know, drop-in sessions, which, you know, if you're building that relationship already, people will already be more willing to, you know, to join. Yes. and ask you questions that they've been thinking about and stewing over.
Yeah, and I tend to have, I wouldn't say a high profile, but a frequent profile on our messaging. They see data protection on our, we have an intranet dashboard that people look at, and data protection comes up. And for data protection, data privacy day, I did cupcakes, and we had our own quiz. Didn't use your quiz. We had our own quiz, which
you was the one complete. That had correct answers to it.
But, no, I didn't say anything there, Phil. I'm not.
No, were they joking?
Only joking. So yeah, we had photos and cupcakes, and I did a fortnightly blog for the months, couple of months.
That's great.
Leading up
yeah.
to it.
Yeah,
it's just getting the message out and being visible and being approachable, and being kind of informal about it. I think the legislation switches people off because they don't understand it and it's hard to get into, and it's there for us to interpret, not to hit people around the head with. So I think just being informal and engaging with people goes a long way.
Sounds good.
You touched on a really good point there, because me and Joe were talking earlier about the language that you use when you talk to people, because it can be hard when you know you live in data protection to speak in layman's terms and not just, you know, overface people. Even the term personal data can be misinterpreted. So it's really trying to explain what, you know, the scope of data protection and how it does affect people, you know, rather than it just being, oh, it's okay, I don't collect names, I'm just talking about X from number 7 at
I don't want to turn it into an exercise to show them how clever I am. That's not what I'm doing when I'm talking with them. You're absolutely right. And it is, I do have to, obviously, if I'm writing to them, I'll mention terms like data subject and data control, and because that's what I know. And it certainly illustrates that I am talking about legislation here. So it's important. But I do that in amongst that conversation. You know, and I'll say, you know, if I say data processing, it means all these different things. When you say storage, I think this. So I do have to kind of explain that to them. But it is a fine balance. You don't want to come off like a smart ass, to be honest. If I'm allowed
and
to
make
use that
people
language,
switch off as well.
Well, it will switch people off, and they'll think, you know, I'm just trying to demonstrate, as I say, how learned I am. They're not really interested. They just want to get their job done. And that's all I want to help them do.
Yeah. Good point. It is quite, it's a jargon filled thing, isn't it? So, you know, you just got to try and work with, you know, the people, the understanding, you know, yes, if they can use the, you know, understand the correct terms, fine. But I mean, even we debate what is personal data, don't we? I mean, it's a movable feast. It's ill defined. So you can't expect everyone to be able to understand everything that we say. They've got to think about how we phrase it.
Yeah. And there's so many acronyms as well that all sound so similar. You've got DPA is in Data Processing Agreement, DPA 18 is in Data Protection Act, DPIA,
IPA, DSA.
It can be hard. And the thing that I do, to be fair, when I'm explaining something to someone or try to do at least, is imagine talking to myself before I started in data protection. And what I would understand and how I would understand it, and then I choose my words in that sense. I mean, some people that I talk to that are listening in might disagree with me, but I try to make a conscious effort at times to just to speak in ways that I would have understood before I was in data protection, really.
Yeah, now Vaughan mentioned cupcakes, and
it all comes back to food.
Well, it maybe it does
for us.
I don't know, but before we were on the session here, am I still on or have I fallen off?
You are, and there's 10 different days by the looks of it, or 12.
Yeah, so just again, just in prep for this, I thought, well, what are the kind of days in the year that we could, and there's loads, you could do one every week if you wanted to, but you know, these are kind of examples of 12 days in the calendar year, internationally recognised days that you could potentially piggyback some kind of data protection or cyber awareness programme on. So, you know, I asked ChatGPT, if I'm being honest, to come up with a list. It came up with some, asked it for a few more. It suggested that August the 12th, this is funny, August the 12th, ChatGPT said it, World Elephant Day, abstractly address the elephants in the room regarding data privacy and security issues that are often overlooked or ignored. I've used Word Elephant Day in the past because they've got good memories about retention and retention of data, but I just liked the ChatGPT creativity here. It's amazing. But again, that's another thing. And training is one thing, awareness raising another. What Vaughan's saying is he gets out, he goes and sees people and uses some of these days to just re-emphasize certain points.
Yeah, because there's a lot of you know, talk about data protection in January and in May, really, when it's Data Protection Day and then, you know, the GDPR's birthday. But you want this to be a consistent thing. And, you know, some people use newsletters on a monthly basis, which are really useful, but it can be hard to keep on top of. If you use examples such as these days, then it gives you a bit of a drive and some relevance for people to grab their attention.
Every time we talk about these kind of international days, I say, you know, I would like to set up some kind of support system where we were using these things and doing awareness raising as a service, you know, so we'll provide some materials, we'll help, you know, do some awareness raising quizzes and things. We have to make sure that they're obviously at the right level and correct in terms of the answers if we're going to do it. But, you know, I think that we don't all have to do this individually. We could actually be doing, you know, sharing, and as we are here, sharing and collaborating on good ideas.
Yeah.
Or ideas.
It's worth saying at this point as well, before everyone drops off, that, you know, these sessions, I know a lot of people that use them for training, but if you do want, you know, more in-depth training, do send us an email at info@dataprotectionpeople. We've got a data protection management training course coming up in March. So, yeah, if you're interested in that, let us know and we can send you further details. But yeah, I like Gary's dedicated day in the chat for DPDI cancelled day. I think we'd all be celebrating that one.
Yeah,
for the data protection bill.
Now, I had missed that Gary was on, so I mean, I mentioned earlier that Orbit was one of the housing associations that had this board game. I don't know whether if that was before your time, Gary, or if you've seen copies of it lying about. I'm not asking you for a comment now, just I hadn't noticed you were on before.
It was a good decade or so ago, Phil. So sadly, we don't have the board game. We've still got lots of quizzes and polls and things that we do.
You wore it out.
I think it may have gone with the previous DPO. I think they claimed copyright and swung.
Oh, right. Right. Okay. That's a bit offside, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So much for sharing good practice. Nope, it's all mine. Nah.
I'm still hunting for the Wii game. That sounds brilliant.
I
could dig that out.
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it? If you have to find a Wii to go with it as well. So, how would we do? So, what else would we want to cover off, Jasmine, well, on this?
How about we come to the conclusion as to whether we've actually answered the question that we set out to do of how do you motivate the masses?
Do we ever answer the question, or do we go down an absolute
hole? We'll have a motivation too, is Jasmine's usual response.
Yeah. I don't know if I've got the willpower to do a number two on that, but
we'll motivate you, Joe. I think, you know, that there's been a lot of conversation around and tips around how to approach training, how to reach or specify
with food. Definitely seems like the answer.
Yeah, that's a good one. How to be specific and how to target training to specific individuals and then on an organizational level. But what else do you have in mind, Joe?
I don't really have anything in particular in mind, but quite an interesting quote that I've heard before about motivation is that if you leave things up to motivation, you're leaving it up to chance. But if you leave it up to discipline, then it's within your control. So I don't know if that can really apply to this.
Well, I think I think that's quite useful and interesting, because if you're leaving it to motivation and leave it by chance, you're assuming that, you know, people are going to be self-motivated, and they might not be here.
Yeah.
So we've got to, as people have been saying, you've got to provide that framework around people to help encourage them, nurture them, remind them, because this isn't top of everyone's list, is it, when they're getting on doing their day jobs.
I mean, to be fair, Laura does shower us with sweet treats and everything in the office, so I think it does have some effect.
Yeah. Now, I was interested in thinking about the different, you know, types of training. So people have mentioned simulations, I think, you know, sort of you might do a simulation of a disaster recovery. You might do a simulation of a subject access request coming in. You might do all sorts of case study type simulations, which I think are really good. I mean, we do fire drills, don't we? So we want muscle memory when people are going to react in the way we've trained them or asked them to, or defined in procedures. So I don't know, again, this all takes a load of time, a load of effort, a load of resource, but simulations would be really good to do around data protection. On the job training, you know, we do most of the training's off the job, isn't it? It's kind of sat in a room watching e-learning, whatever. But I don't think I've seen much on the job training where you're actually sitting with somebody and they're going through showing you something, you know. And for me, if I'm doing something, it helps it cement it in my brain.
It's real life examples then, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. And then kind of the occupational skills type training is going to be competency based. Now, we've developed a competency framework, haven't we, for our own internal use, where we can target people to move through the competencies and measure them, which is, again, a quite useful approach. And there are now some apprenticeship schemes out, which, again, you could just pull the framework and say, actually, we're going to use this. But I think that's more for privacy practitioners, because that's what our business is, than it is for kind of your operational people. I was just kind of thinking about the different types of training that you could do.
Yeah, I mean, you could get creative with it, and I suppose it depends on who or the scale of what the training will be. You know, it'll be much more difficult to get creative with it if it's across the organization. That's why people fall into the trap of e-learning. I say trap, you know, it can have benefits obviously, but I don't think it's as useful as intended. But if it's, you know, specific to a department, like Vaughan was saying, these drop-in sessions into departments meetings and stuff, they can be really effective, but it's a case-by-case basis, I think.
Yeah. So motivating the masses, inspiring your workforce about data protection, have we answered the question? I think we've had a good session talking about, you know, good practices. We've got some good ideas that have come out in the chat. I think it's been you know, interesting. I'm not sure we've answered the question. I'm not sure there is an answer to the question. I think it maybe depends from workplace to workplace.
Yeah, definitely. It depends on the existing culture, really. But anything you can do to inspire excitement, you know, is a positive. And there is excitement to be found as well, just through those real world examples and really driving it home. It's not just, you know, a piece of legislation that and policies and procedures that you need to know inside out. It's real life, isn't it?
Yeah. Now we're at the bottom of the hour, Jazz, so I'm afraid we've probably run out of time.
Yeah. So thank you everyone for joining. It's been a good session. A lot of thought-provoking chat in the chat as well as, well, hopefully with us. please join us next session for another GDPR Radio. Like I said earlier, if you want to inquire more about what training services we provide, drop us an email at info@dataprotectionpeople.com. And in the meantime, have a great weekend. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.